The world's fish are in trouble. Fishermen are pulling them out of the sea far faster than the fish populations can grow back. Some fisheries are heading toward collapse or even extinction. But a major new analysis shows that fisheries aren't all doomed. In fact, some are on the mend, as NPR's Richard Harris reports.
3 years ago, Boris Worm and his colleagues at Dalhousie University in Canada sent shockwaves through the world of fishing and fisheries science. They published a paper showing that if current trends continued, the ocean would essentially be fished out by the middle of this century. The paper was enormously controversial, both for its methods and its conclusions. But the controversy didn't just generate heat, it has generated light.
Coming out of that controversy is some of the critics and myself and some of my coworkers and then a lot of other people who were interested in the topic got together to do what's probably the most detailed assessment of world fisheries to date.
Worm says this new analysis relies on much more scientific data to assess the state of the world's fisheries. And it's still not an upbeat report.
This trend in increasing species collapse that we found in the previous paper still persists.
But this paper, which is published in Science magazine, then goes a step farther.
What this paper shows is there are solutions, and those solutions are beginning to work in a number of places.
Some of the good news stories come from the United States. Strict federal fishing laws have cut back significantly on overfishing. For example, haddock off New England have rebounded so well they're actually as healthy as they've ever been. Iceland, too, has rebuilt some of its fisheries. There's also a good news story from Kenya. Their fishery scientists have been working with the traditional fishermen.
And the solutions they found was to ban a certain fishing gear, which was very unselective and was catching a lot of the fish before they could grow and reproduce. It's called a beach seine. And then the second solution was to implement closed areas.
Boris Worm says fish reproduced in the closed areas safely and then spread out to repopulate the overfished areas.
And that has worked exceptionally well. And over a period of less than 10 years, the income of individual fishermen from the fishery has actually doubled in those areas that had both the net removed and the closed area in place.
For every hopeful example, there are many depressing ones. The worst one they document is in Europe. There, fish managers are letting fishermen drive the majestic bluefin tuna toward extinction.
Our analysis actually shows that eastern bluefin tuna is the most overfished of all the species we looked at, meaning that the rate it's captured is about 10 times higher than what would be sustainable.
Overall, 80% of Europe's fisheries are being overfished. And China is also fishing unsustainably on the high seas, but the facts there are sketchy. Steve Murawski, chief scientist at the National Marine Fisheries Service, says this new research is pretty realistic. It shows that fisheries aren't, in fact, doomed to extinction.
In the majority of cases, in fact, virtually all the cases where fishing rates have been cut substantially, we've seen a positive response. And that is a pivotal result of this paper. It basically says that fishery management works.
The issue is getting over what can be a painful transition from overfishing to a lower but sustainable rate of fishing. That often means short-term pain as fishing boats and fishermen are forced into retirement.
It's up to us. If we want sustainable fisheries, we can achieve them.
And as the new research makes clear, that's a question of political will, not a lack of scientific knowledge. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And next, we will hear a sound from nature. Our series Wild Sounds puts a microphone to the animal kingdom. Biologist Andy Bass of Cornell University has been listening to the midshipman fish.
That's from the plainfin midshipman fish. They have an air-filled bladder known as a swim bladder that most fishes use to change their position in the water column, but many fish have secondarily adapted this organ for sound production. Individual males build a territory, if you will, under a rocky shelter. And from that rocky shelter, they produce that hum advertisement call to attract females to their nest. We put a hydrophone out by a nest, and then at night, which is when they start becoming very vocal, we could record all of those sounds. Now, the other sound you heard coming in the background is the hum from a neighboring male. The other guy is humming at the same time, competing perhaps with that other male, trying to attract a female to his nest. The grunt is the simplest signal that they produce. It's very brief in duration. It appears to depend on whether or not another male actually gets inside of a nest of a male. What we've discovered is the same regions of the brain that a fish uses to produce sound. In fact, I can show you those same regions in the brain of a human or a bird or a frog. We were out recording these sounds at the study site up in Washington State. And then, sure enough, right about 9 o'clock at night, suddenly the water becomes alive with sound. And it goes on for hours. And it's just incredible to listen to. We're sitting there with earphones glued to our heads, listening to these fish all night, making these growls and hums and grunts.
Thanks to NPR's Christopher Joyce for tracking down our wild sounds, including the midshipman fish, which are part of the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology collection. Jellyfish can grow to be pretty large, but they're nothing compared to the size of the ocean. So it may come as some surprise to hear that jellyfish and similar animals could be influencing oceans and the climate on a global scale. That's what a report in this week's issue of the journal Nature suggests. NPR's Jeff Broomfield has more.
It's not obvious that jellyfish would be involved in something as important as climate change. They're not particularly exciting animals. They don't have fins or teeth or even eyes to speak of. And they bob around in pretty much the same way that their ancestors did half a billion years ago.
If you see them in the ocean, you think of them as sort of the leftovers in the gene pool, if you will.
That's John DeBeery. He's a bioengineer at Caltech who has been studying jellyfish for the better part of a decade.
However, jellyfish are actually the first animals to use muscle power to swim. They've survived some major extinction events. And so we actually see them as a model system for successful propulsion now.
In fact, they're more successful than DeBeery, who, as it turns out, is a lousy swimmer. But he's got the upper hand when it comes to fluid mechanics. He's devoted a lot of time to learning about the swirls and eddies that jellyfish make as they swim. For decades, some scientists have speculated that swimming animals might contribute to stirring up water in the oceans. And that's where climate change comes in. Carbon dioxide from the air dissolves in the surface layer of the ocean. Stirring up the ocean sends that dissolved carbon dioxide to the bottom and stores it there. To find out whether jellyfish were helping the process, his team filmed dozens of the animals. It wasn't easy.
We actually had a jellyfish that we were measuring out in Woods Hole. It's a place where we go quite often. And you have to understand that it can take a half an hour to get an animal in the perfect position to take these measurements. And right when the animal was set up, a crab comes out and grabs it in its claw and pulls it away. So we lost our data.
After studying the tapes, DeBeery and his team noticed something. As jellyfish swim, they stir up the water, but they also pull it along behind them. And DeBeery says it could work on a large scale. That's because every night, jellyfish and other smaller creatures swim thousands of feet up to the surface to feed. They may be dragging up cold water without much carbon dioxide in it, and pulling down warm water filled with carbon dioxide when they return to the depths. So could jellyfish help to combat climate change?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that jellyfish are a solution to global warming.
Bill Dewar, an oceanographer at Florida State University.
What I think we can say defensively at the moment is that it's a plausible idea, plausible input to mixing, which has been overlooked.
DeBeery says this work means that swimming marine life may need to be accounted for in future computer models of climate change. To do that, scientists need to know more about how the animals behave.
So it really is a big question mark as to exactly where the animals are at any given time and which animals are generating the mixing. We need more data.
For John DeBeery's colleagues, that's good news and bad. They're going to be traveling to more great ocean dive spots, but they're also probably going to be getting a lot more jellyfish stings. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Scientists who study the far northern regions of the planet say they're seeing some odd things happening to the snow. They call them rain-on-snow events. Sometimes, when the weather warms suddenly, it rains instead of snows. The rain percolates into the snowpack and freezes into a hard sheet of ice. In the Arctic, it apparently can have deadly effects. NPR's Christopher Joyce has more.
It's taken years for scientists to figure out just what happened in October 2003 on Banks Island in far northern Canada. Geologist Jaakko Putkonen is one of those scientists.
There was this huge big rain or snow event, and there was a huge big herd of musk oxen living there.
Musk oxen are pretty huge and big as well. They're shaggy and cow-like, though closer relatives to goats than oxen. But as huge and big as they are, they couldn't break through the ice sheet to browse on the plants under the snowpack.
And long story short, about 20,000 musk oxen starved to death because of this event.
20,000?
Yeah, it's a humongous number.
It wasn't until the following year, when wildlife biologists started finding the carcasses of starved musk oxen, that they realized something had gone terribly wrong out there in the snow. But Conan has since discovered a few anecdotal accounts of big rain-on-snow events that killed reindeer in the Arctic and Scandinavia. But he says it's hard to actually study them. Even if you put down instruments to record one, they freeze up or get snowed under. Moreover, is it a big deal? But Conan and his fellow rain-on-snow experts, there aren't many in this specialty yet, think it is. They suspect that a warming climate may increase the number and geographic reach of these events. Tom Grenfell is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Washington.
If the climate warms up, it doesn't just grow palm trees in sunny Fairbanks, Alaska. It creates more storms and mixes the atmosphere up a lot more.
Grenfell and Putkonen suspect that warmer weather and more storms could mean more rain on snow instead of snow on snow. Grenfell says that could affect people who live in the high northern latitudes.
There are other places around the Arctic that have these things, like Finland and Russia, where people herd reindeer or caribou and depend for their livelihood on these things.
But so far, no one knows if these events are increasing or not. No one has ever checked. That's what Putkonen and Grenfell are planning to do next. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.